Thank you, Hiski, very much for being prompt in time. And you set up a model for the next speaker. I'd like to invite Derek Ketchum from University of Texas to be the second panelist and to give us a paper on tired feet and empty pockets, the Montgomery and Alexandra bus boycott in comparative perspective. Derek, please.
So earlier in the week, news reports on the protests going on in Brazil had reports that there were some of the protesters who were protesting very explicitly a rise in bus fares. And that rise in bus fares was added up to about 17 cents in American money, which I guess is about 10% in the wallet draining currency here. And in the blog Daily Intel for New York Magazine, a guy by the name of Dan Amara, traditionally a good, solid lefty in his politics, kind of made fun of that, made fun of the idea that people would protest over 17 cents. And I think that's a useful thing to think about, because one of the areas of boycotts that I think we tend to overlook are subsistence boycotts. Boycotting something because it becomes too expensive. And that's one of the examples that I'll be dealing with when I talk about boycotts in the US and especially in South Africa in the period from 1940 to 1960, which is the project I'm working on, particularly looking at Alexandra bus boycotts in 1957 and the Montgomery bus boycotts. In early January 1957, South Africa's Public Utility Transport Corporation, PUTCO, announced that it would be raising bus fares by 1 penny from 4 to 5 cents. This would be the first fare increase on PUTCO buses in 20 years, spokesman for the parastatal organization announced, and was largely the result of rising petroleum costs. The fare hike would take place effective on 7th of January, which was a Monday. In response, more than 2,000 black South Africans in the northern Johannesburg township of Alexandra met under the leadership of the Alexandra People's Transport Committee, the APTC, and voted to commence a boycott of PUTCO. That Monday, thousands heeded the boycott, with APTC estimated that more than 4,000 walked the 9+ miles into Johannesburg, the main center of employment opportunities for township dwellers. Residents of Sophiatown also boycotted PUTCO services, as did those in Lady Selborne, a Pretoria township where fares had also increased. PUTCO officials estimated that Monday ridership was down to 2% of its normal levels, and by the 8th, the boycott was total, with no black riders in Alexandra. The rallying cry for the boycotters was Azikwelwa, which in Zulu means we will not ride, and which, in a nod to history, was itself borrowed from bus protest campaigns of the 1940s. What followed would be a 3-month standoff between PUTCO, government officials, and an increasingly emboldened protest movement. 13 months before the commencement of the Alexandra boycott, Rosa Parks, a stalwart of Montgomery, Alabama's civil rights struggle, a longtime NAACP activist, and a respected community member, refused to give up her seat when the bus driver told her to do so. According to Montgomery segregation laws, Parks' refusal to yield made her subject to arrest, and so the bus driver contacted police, who carted Parks to jail. On December 5th, Parks was convicted of violating Montgomery Jim Crow laws, and Montgomery's black population engaged in a 1-day bus boycott that proved to be a rousing success. Montgomery's African-American community decided to continue with the boycott. What followed would be a 13-month standoff between Montgomery City bus lines, local officials, and an increasingly emboldened protest movement. The comparisons between the Montgomery and Alexandra bus boycotts, and bus boycotts generally in the 40s and 50s, both in the US and South Africa, seem obvious at first, and some of the parallels are striking. Both movements saw the emergence of what appeared to be an almost ad hoc mass protest based upon principles of nonviolence in the wake of what had become an intolerable situation, oftentimes characterized by abuse, violence, state terrorism, and mistreatment. In both cases, women took active roles in organizing and sustaining the boycotts. An impressive array of informal transportation networks emerged in both instances, including the development of shuttle services, carpools, and taxis. Masses oftentimes simply compensated for the buses being off limits by traveling on foot or on bicycle. Police and other authorities resorted to intimidation, duplicity, and violence. There were disagreements of tactics within each movement. The boycotts also proved to be a source of charismatic leadership, though this was much more pronounced in the American case, where Martin Luther King Jr. ascended to what would become his truncated run as the most visible and significant civil rights leader in America, and arguably the best known or one of the best known symbols for freedom and human rights in the world. Now, there are also significant disjunctions between the cases, particularly the place where laws come from. So that in South Africa, for example, you're dealing with a national government that is buttressing these rules through apartheid, whereas in the United States, you're dealing with local and state laws first and foremost. And so there are fairly significant differences as well, which is important. The political scientist Tom Lodge has called the bus boycotts in Everton and in Alexandra, which are the largest of their kind, the two major subsistence protests of the 1950s in South Africa. A description that is accurate, but I think incomplete and misleading. The proximate cause of the boycotts was the rise in fares. Indeed, one of the phrases that emerged from the boycott, in conjunction with Azikwelwa, was Asinamali, which means we have no money. And was intended not as a lamentation, but rather as an assertion of defiance in recognition of how racism and poverty were inextricably linked in the South African context. The boycotts did not attempt to address larger problems in the system that left Africans vulnerable to a penny a day fare increase. But the root cause of the bus boycott stemmed from the circumstances that created a place like Alexandra to begin with. Africans were disproportionately, indeed almost exclusively, concerned with and thus affected by rising fares because Africans were most reliant upon public transportation. The economic sector being what it was in the townships, largely informal, with virtually no industry, a small to non-existent public service sector, almost no public sector jobs and so forth, meant that to find steady employment, Africans had to go to the city, to Johannesburg, in order to work. Because of the host of segregation and later apartheid laws, Africans had no choice but to live in the townships and commute to the cities. Furthermore, given the political climate and increasingly totalitarian nature of the apartheid state, which would only get worse in the years to come, especially after the Sharpeville massacre in March of 1960, protesting against fares was a proxy for protesting against apartheid after the National Party victory in 1948. The buses were a tangible manifestation of a holistically closed society. Boycotting rising fares was tantamount to challenging apartheid, even if the leaders of the boycott movements knew that to assert as much meant to violate a host of laws that could lead to imprisonment and worse. The 1957 boycotts took place within the context of the treason trials against the leaders of the Freedom Charter movement of the African National Congress, after all. Punishment for political activism was thus not an abstraction for boycott participants. As one contemporary of the boycotters wrote in 1958, the people of the dark city of Alexandra, it was called the dark city because there was no electricity, and so when nightfall came, it was quite literally the dark city. An unusually stubborn and independent suburb of 100,000 Africans lying just outside the municipality were united in their dislike for the smoky green buses called Tigers, the long queues waiting without shelter, sometime for an hour and a half in the early mornings, the rude and autocratic officials, and the cramped, uncomfortable journey stood for everything that was most hated about the white men's city to which the buses carried tens of thousands of workers every day. The extra penny touched off all this latent hatred. Challenging bus fares thus represented a challenge to apartheid and white supremacy in one of the only ways that might have been able to prove effective under the circumstances. One of the remarkable discoveries one, by which I mean me, makes when investigating bus boycotts in the United States and South Africa during the middle 20th century is how relatively little cross-pollination there was between the two movements. It would seem logical, indeed obvious, that there must have been a great deal of communication and consolidation crossing the Atlantic, that the architects of Montgomery must have been deeply immersed in the events in Alexandra, and that the South Africans must have looked to the Americans for inspiration or ideas or strategy. And indeed, I've heard this fairly regularly when I talk to Americans about this in particular. They find out that Alexandra happened after Montgomery, and they say, oh, the South Africans must have learned so much from the Montgomery bus boycott, because there is no one as solipsistic as Americans when it comes to this sort of thing. And as evidence of that, apparently that statement proves that we're even solipsistic about our solipsism. But it's simply not the case. And I wish it were. It's better to write a book with these clear transnational connections rather than ones that I have to sort of forge obliquely. There's no doubt the two movements were aware of one another, but there's even less of a question that despite similarities in circumstances, neither black Americans nor their African counterparts needed to look elsewhere to grasp white supremacy or to develop strategies to combat their circumstances. South Africans had no need to look to America to understand white supremacy, nor did Alabamans have any need to consult events in South Africa. It would be to deny agency to both to demand that they looked to one another for guidance and for help. But the lack of coordination between the two movements, far from diminishing a study of the two, raises provocative possibilities. The movements did develop along similar lines. They developed similar strategies. They adapted to circumstances in ways that echo one another. And the architects of white supremacy, too, acted in ways that seemed to respond to their cross-Atlantic counterparts. Yet the lack of explicit transnational communication or mimicry indicates something else, what we, by which I mean me, might call simultaneity. For the fact that different actors in different places responded to comparable but unique circumstances might well tell us something about the commonalities inherent in human rights struggles. That the South African and American context lack coordination does not in and of itself speak to an absence of transnational currents. Transnationalism need not be conscious to be demonstrable. In the middle of the Alexandra bus boycott, Dan Mokonyane, assistant secretary of the APTC and a law student at the University of the Witwatersrand, joined several of his more radical Africanist colleagues in calling for a transforming the boycott into a general strike. At a mass meeting, Mokonyane declared, "When we are tired, we shall rest. They are punishing us because we are poor." In Montgomery, meanwhile, there's the famous story of Mother Pollard, as she was known far and wide. When offered a ride during the boycott and told that everyone would understand if she chose to ride the buses, Mother Pollard famously responded, "My feet is tired, but my soul is rested." In both South Africa and the United States in the 1950s, tired feet and rested souls embraced the principles behind Azikiwelwa and Asinamali. The circumstances and context were different, but the universality of the desire for human rights marched on in the obstinate face of oppression. Feet spoke eloquently as the poor walked on, taking dignity where it had been stolen and demanding justice where it was absent. A deeper understanding of both struggles together may well help us to better grasp the significance of each separately. And I want to point out a couple of other possible connections. One aspect about the South African bus boycotts that one must recognize is that they had been much more frequent than American boycotts. There had been American bus boycotts in Harlem in 1943, in Baton Rouge in 1953, a kind of quaint and ignored one at Duke University in 1949, and then the Montgomery bus boycott and the Tallahassee bus boycotts. And those were effectively the need to boycott along these lines was brought to an end with Supreme Court decisions that quite clearly got rid of the segregation laws in Montgomery and Tallahassee and elsewhere. Whereas in South Africa, there were relatively frequent bus boycotts from 1941 or so through last week, really. And as a consequence, that's another reason why the South Africans weren't looking to the United States, because they had very much their own model. And it wasn't always subsistence. A lot of times it was treatment or needing black drivers or mechanics or what have you. And in fact, I spent the morning at the Institute for Commonwealth Studies doing research on a tram boycott in the Witwatersrand in 1949. So they were much more common. And these transnational linkings, I should point out, were developing in the 1950s in a way that they hadn't prior to that. And in fact, America was rather late to the game of the anti-apartheid movement. By this point, you had the slow emergence of the anti-apartheid movement that would accelerate in Britain in particular, as well as elsewhere in Europe, that really didn't take place until after 1960 and really until the 70s and 80s in the United States. I also want to point out one more thing, and then I'll close off, which is that the reader for the manuscript proposal said in the comments that one of the concerns that he had was that 1948 meant that the two countries in the 1940s were going in vastly different directions. And so in my introduction, I actually take issue with that, because I'm not convinced that from the vantage point of 1947, one could have looked at Mississippi on the one hand and South Africa on the other hand and said demonstrably that the countries would go in the direction that they did. That Mississippi was any less of a closed society than South Africa in 1947. One must also keep in mind that the 1948 elections that brought apartheid did not bring the National Party a majority victory. They needed to forge a coalition of 12 members of parliament with another party in order to rule. And so, in fact, they may have been going in different directions, but I would argue that 1960 is a better year to see that clear change of direction, and not necessarily 1948. And there is a tendency, particularly among historians of South Africa in the apartheid, post-apartheid period, to see all of South African history building up to 1948. And that isn't necessarily the case. And furthermore, there's no reason to imagine that events had to play out in the United States after 1948 in the way that they did as well. So I think it's a lot more complex, the interplay between them. And I welcome any comments or questions or anything. Thank you very much.